I enjoyed seeing Lee Cox's comments in yesterday's newspaper about alternative ways of celebrating Christmas as opposed to compiling an ever larger list of obligatory presents. A good friend had just told me how it had become a custom in his part of town to give a Christmas present of a few dollars to the trash collector. Some of the collectors had learned to remind their customers by taping a card to the trash cans, "Season's greeting from your trash collector." Well, my friend said, last year I forgot to respond to the first greeting card, and so a day or two before Christmas, another card showed up on my trash can. It said, "Season's greeting from your trash collector, second notice." My comments this morning have nothing more to do with obligatory giving, but they do focus on memories. Because of all our religious holidays, the Christmas season is likely to call up more of them than any of the others. But as most of you know, memories can be bittersweet. In The Word of Life, which Michaeline read a few minutes ago, the beloved author of Peter Pan said that God gave us memories that we might have roses in December. It was his poetic way of reminding us that memories can summon up the happiest times we have ever known, turning darkness into light and loneliness into company. But the Scottish playwright knew as well as anyone that this is only part of the truth, that memories can also be painful. Painful in the moments when they suddenly remind us of a past when life was full of hope and innocence and we had not yet betrayed a friendship or violated a trust. As a friend of mine remarked once, if you have a completely clear conscience, you probably have a poor memory. Or as a few embarrassed husbands have learned, memory can be the unpleasant reminder that your wife's birthday was last week. All of which is meant as a prologue to a sermon of very serious intent. I couldn't decide this week between two different beginnings for this sermon, so I kept them both. You get the slightly more formal beginning first. When I settled on The Paradox of Memory as a title, I wanted to signal the contradictory nature of that uniquely human faculty, that it can be both a blessing and a burden, and that sometimes it's almost impossible to separate the two. I'll try to show you what I mean with an example from the New Testament. There was the moment one night when a rooster crowed and a follower of Jesus named Simon Peter suddenly remembered something. Thousands of times before in his life, that barnyard sound had only been a signal to get up and get ready for some early morning fishing on the clear waters of Lake Galilee. But this time, it meant something else. His friend, his sometimes incomprehensible but always magnetic friend, whose name was Jesus, had told his followers soon after an evening meal together that on that very night they would lose faith in him and run away. Peter, always impulsive, drew himself up and boasted that even if those other guys are scared into being disloyal and cowardly, he never will. But Jesus read people with clear-eyed honesty and loved them no less because they were a mix of strength and weakness. So with what must have been a sad but gentle smile, he looks at his friend, the fisherman, and says, "I tell you, Peter, that this very night, before the cock crows, you will have disowned me 3 times. A bold and confident man, Peter was not used to being doubted. No, no, he protested, even if it means dying beside you, I will never disown you. But it was only 2 or 3 hours later, after Jesus had been arrested, that first to a servant girl, then to another young woman, and finally to a group of hostile bystanders, Peter vowed that he absolutely did not know the prisoner named Jesus. Immediately after this third denial, when Matthew says he even added a few curse words for emphasis, a rooster crowed the coming of day, and Peter remembered. And the memory drove him out into the darkness to weep tears of shame and remorse. It must have been almost unbearable. But even in that scalding flood of memory, there was also the cleansing water of rebirth. Never again would he boast quite so nonchalantly of what he could do. Never again would he boast in pride and be so terribly disgraced. Memory. This gift we are talking about would see to that. Have you ever thought what it must have been like for Peter every day for the rest of his life to hear a rooster's morning cry in some tiny Galilean village? A sound that would always be bittersweet, a reminder of how weak he had been, an incentive to spend the rest of his days proving his courage, at once a painful and a saving memory. And there is another story in the New Testament which makes use of memory, although this one is a piece of teaching fiction rather than literal fact. It's a little short story, we call them parables, about a rich man and a ragged beggar who lay huddled at his gate every day hoping for a handout. The story has both men die, with the beggar ending up in Abraham's bosom, a Jewish idiom for heaven, and the rich man in a place of torment, pleading for the man he had ignored in life to dip his finger in cool water and cross the great gulf between them with blessed relief. It is Father Abraham himself who responds to that request, and he starts out by saying, "Son, remember, it's a solemn beginning, because this little story is built on the notion that the memory of our lost opportunities is one way of describing hell. Son, remember your huge surplus of good things while you lived on earth and how greedy about them you became. Remember how many times you passed that huddled heap at your gate and did nothing." In the story, of course, it's too late for the rich man to make his memory become a door of hope, but it's being told for an audience that's still alive, and its point is that perhaps their memories of selfish moments may change them before it's too late. This actually happens to some of us. The bad taste of what we are is in our mouth one evening, along with an image in the mirror of a face we aren't at all sure we really like. And suddenly we are stabbed with the memory of what we promised ourselves we would be when we were younger and full of idealism and hope. Or we're all set to lie in words or by cowardly silence, or to steal something tangible like money or intangible like someone's reputation. And suddenly there rises the memory of a friend or a parent who held integrity higher than any form of self-indulgence, and we are stabbed with shame. Or perhaps shabby behavior has become such a pattern that we are riddled day and night with anxiety and guilt until there comes upon us like a dam breaking the memory of a time when we were at peace and could sleep without a shadow in our heart. How well we have all known the curious power of this thing called memory. Well, that's one way I thought of beginning. But I also thought I'd like to begin in a much less formal way, like this. You have probably all played a little mental game in which you try to dredge up the very first things you recall from your childhood. However strange they may seem to others, those were moments of intensity for you, so that out of all the things that happened, you remember those things. Perhaps the first time someone you loved went with you to a circus or a zoo to see elephants and tigers and the tall, stick-legged creatures with the long neck. Or the time your mother let you mix the dough for the cake or sent you on your first errand into the next block by yourself. Maybe it was the first time you got a letter through the mail with your name on it. Or the smell and taste of the first strawberry you picked from a garden. Or perhaps the first time you became conscious that someone loved you and what that moment meant, and the sense of ecstasy as you began to understand it. I was with a son the other day whose life revolves around language as mine does, and we ask each other what the very first word was that ever excited us by the magic of its sound and meaning. He said that for him it was the word crunch, used to describe the sound of walking on snow as a teacher read aloud in grade school. He had no idea that it was a good example of onomatopoeia. He just loved saying it over and over for himself, thrilled by the sound of it. His first experience with the power of language. Memory brought back a similar experience for me. My father owned a furniture store in which I spent many hours, and when he told me one day that a certain lovely piece of furniture was cherry wood, I thought the sound of that was absolutely beautiful. It sounded rich and exotic, and at that moment, ridiculous as it may seem, my love of the miracle of language was born. We're all curious about this thing called memory, this faculty that the rest of the animal kingdom seems not to have except in the most minimal way, this power to summon up the past and parade it before our minds again for whatever nourishment it offers. We pay homage to that power all the time. We begin 1,000 conversations this way. Do you remember when we were kids and we did this, went there? Do you remember those fishing trips to the White River and the time a spring storm hit just as a 4-pound bass slammed into your lure and you had to fight that fish in a torrential rain? Do you remember how your dad used to concentrate so hard at checkers that his pipe would go out? So do we trigger for ourselves one of the most delightful exercises we know. Nor is it merely a social exercise. We pay homage to the power of memory even when we are alone by deliberately willing our recollections. We stare into the fire on a winter night and memories dance. We watch the leaves fall on an October afternoon and they remind us of the years that have drifted slowly down from the summers of our lives. Memory like that is a mixture of pain and joy, but we tolerate the pain because there is no other way to reach the happiness part. We treasure certain objects that we know will give us that strange combination of joy and sorrow. I showed you once a crude little spindle made of plaster of Paris with a sharp nail stuck through it that was brought home to me one day by a little boy in the third grade. It has some green and yellow felt strips glued on it and a sprinkle of gaudy little stars on top. And it was made so Dad could stick papers on it. I never used it. Given my abrupt movements, it was too dangerous to keep it on the desk. I would have stabbed myself sooner or later, but I have kept it on a shelf safely above the desk for 40 years, while the child who made it grew up and forgot all about it. And every time I happen to see it, there is a touch of sadness for days that are lost forever, and a touch of joy that the child is safely grown up and that the old love remains between us. I look at a seashell saved from a wonderful family trip, at a tiny piece of forbidden marble brought back illegally from the Parthenon by a friend more loving than wise, at an acorn I picked up once and kept as a memento of a perfect afternoon. My life, like yours, is a collage of mementos like that. So I understand why St. Augustine wrote his great treatise on memory. He was prompted, I think, by recollections of his mother, Monica, whose love for him while he was a wild and reckless boy tugged at his conscience until he finally succumbed to an even higher love and became one of the most influential Christians of all time. But the gift of memory is always a paradox. A picture of a boy and his dog hangs in the barn owned by a special friend of mine. It stirs in me fond memories of his gentle ways, of having him in a freshman class, of his trusting me enough to talk about his love life at midnight once on our back porch. Cherished memories. But inside the lovely curled petals of those memories, there lies a hidden thorn, because the picture also reminds me of his mother's frantic call one Sunday afternoon to say that her son had just lost his life in a tragic accident. No other living creature is teased and tormented as we are by the paradox of memory. Memories can even be dangerous for some who decide to live in them, who become obsessed with the past because it stays the same, because it's so much less demanding than the present. This is what a poet meant who said, "Memory is a crazy woman who hoards colored rags and throws away food." The food of the present, of course. To become a slave to memories is probably worse than not having any at all. And it's also necessary to know that some memories are of unresolved guilt or regret, which, unless we confront them, destroy our peace of mind. I meet good people who have made mistakes and ask God and others for forgiveness, but who cannot take the final step and forgive themselves. Memory for them becomes an intolerable burden. If it's true, as we are told, that it's impossible for us to forget anything, that somewhere in the computer bank of the mind is the memory of everything we ever did that ever happened to us, then it certainly makes sense to be very careful about the memories we make, even in what may seem trivial ways. For example, anytime I need its help, I can see the tranquil beauty of England's Tintern Abbey, because I made a pilgrimage there once, remembering Wordsworth's hope that memories of a visit there with his sister would bless her life long after he was no longer around. He saw to it that her mind was filled with such images, so that even if she lived in London, she could summon up at will the healing balm of natural beauty. As someone said in a poem I've otherwise forgotten, a weary city dweller, to survive, must keep some cool green memory alive. I've made it work for myself more than once, stalled on a hot August day in heavy traffic, watching heat waves shimmer on the pavement. I have at times, by an act of will, called up a saving memory, the sound of a waterfall beside a Colorado cabin, the laughter of a loon on a clear Minnesota lake, the low thunder of surf during glorious days and nights by the ocean. It works. So well, in fact, that Sarah Teasdale was describing what is or ought to be a universal human experience in these lines. Into my heart's treasury I slipped a coin that time cannot take, nor a thief purloin. Oh, better than the minting of a gold-crowned king is the safe-kept memory of a lovely thing. On this first Sunday of most people's favorite holiday season, my December wish for all of you is that the familiar carols and the colored lights, the Merry Christmas greetings of passing strangers, will call up a host of happy memories of days gone by and make you wish to create them for others, especially for children and for the unloved of this world. It's part of what it means to walk in the steps of one who said, "These things have I told you that you may remember."